Hey Rollers, it's Josh from Quid Pro Roll, your favorite soup-slinging, wacky wrestling, dragon-defenestrating actual play podcast. Are you interested in epic prophecies, frazzled GMs, arson? Check us out! While you're at it, check out the other sweet shows on the May Contain Action Network. Forgotten Paths, Unvaulted, May Contain Action, and the Goblins and Growlers podcast, all linked here in the show notes.
Hey Goblins, Brandon here. If you enjoy what we do and you'd like to help support us create more and maybe even take the podcast to weekly, then the best way right now that you can support us is to head over to patreon.com/goblinsgrowlers. You can find all the different stuff we do there, one-page dungeons, bonus audio for things, all kinds of stuff. So head on over there, and even if it's just a dollar or, you know, however much you're comfortable doing, or if you can't put anything toward the Patreon, just tell a friend about it. Tell somebody about the podcast. That's another great way to support us. So, patreon.com/goblinsgrowlers, and we'll see y'all soon.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Goblins and Growlers podcast. I'm Josh Maltby, at Black Cloak DM on The Places.
Hey, I'm Brandon Dingus, at Way of Brandalore, also on The Places. It's always funny when we start this recording, because we're chatting, and then we give ourselves like the 3 seconds before you launch into the intro, and I'm sitting here trying to figure out how, like, what facial expression should I have when the video fades in, and it's always a little bit awkward.
I used to have that anytime I was knocking on someone's door, which I would do frequently for Boy Scouts and other fundraising opportunities as a child, with not knowing what to do with my hands. I'd be like, I've knocked on your door. Should I do like a military at ease now and put my hands behind my back? Should I have them in my pockets? Is that weird? Where do they go?
They open the door. You're like, hello, homeowner, and welcome to my Boy Scout something or other pitch. And then clap your
hello,
hands.
Hello, homeowner, and welcome to my pitch for buying tickets to a spaghetti dinner. I'm Josh Maltby.
Real quick, up at the top, we were at Triad down in Winston-Salem, or Salem-Winston, as Josh referred to it throughout the entire weekend.
Called it Salem-Winston like 12 times that weekend. It was not good.
Yeah,
it was not good.
We were at Triad Anime Convention, and we had a great time there. I got to hang out with our pal, Professor Shy Guy, and meet a bunch of new people and see some people that we've met before. If anybody came by and said, hey, we really appreciate it. If you're listening to this for the first time because you met us there, we also really appreciate that. Josh probably has a few more fans than I do from that event because you were part of both of the improv D&Ds that we did and while I had to watch the booth.
Yeah, those Mad Lib tabletop games get a little crazy.
Mm-hmm, especially the 18 plus one.
Honestly, the 18 plus one, it was easier for me to just react to because there was stuff that was referenced in the non-18 plus one that I was like, what is this? Like somebody was like Sonic.exe and Alan and I both were like,
oh. Well, the thing about the 18 plus one is it's not crazy because it's very predictable because your chances are probably, you know, 70-30 when you pull one of the note cards that it's just going to say penis on it or some variation thereof.
I believe that is accurate. Yes.
Yeah. So what are we going to talk about today, Josh?
Today, we talk about a little crazy guy known as Hecna from Hit Point Press.
Yep. This is something that we wanted to talk about for a little while, but we just hadn't gotten around to it, honestly. And it seemed like it fit pretty well in terms of our schedule to be able to do it today. But Hecna is a full like level 1 through level 10 campaign setting from Hit Point Press. And we're going to talk about what it entails. But think of it as sort of Ravenloft Carnival, essentially, that straddles kind of a line between horror and cartoonish once you start drilling down into it. I was first introduced to Hecna at PAX Unplugged last December, hanging out over close to the Hit Point Press table. And it was funny because when I was over there talking to them and I say, oh, Hecna, oh, that's clever. And then right then, like, the tweets start coming out that they've announced the D&D books that are coming out in 2024. The chief among them was Vecna. And the Hit Point Press guys were like, huh. Okay. Okay. But this was, this started as a Kickstarter that they rolled out, I think, in like 2022, like early 2022.
And sounds right.
Yeah. And the it might have been earlier than that, honestly. I can't recall. But the first thing that was released from it was the playtest PDF. And that was in 2022 when that first came out. And then there were a handful of production delays that caused the actual book, the physical book, not to come out until sometime late last year, I think, because you were still seeing people in the updates and online who, as like even earlier this year, still hadn't received their pledge from it. But, you know, they raised like $660,000 to make this happen. Hit Point is very much sort of in that tier with like Nord Games. And I mean, honestly, like all the big folks, like your Pathfinders and stuff like that, as far as Kickstarters for raising money for supplements. And that's just, I used to have an issue with big companies doing that, you know, quote unquote, big companies, right? But pretty much any publishing company is struggling to make the economics work. So I don't think it's a big deal anymore. Like when somebody like Lauren Small, who did Born from Ice, does it, like they're basically a small few person shop over there. Like it makes a little more sense to me. But, you know, Hit Point, they're really well known for Humblewood. They do really great work with 5e compatible stuff. So immediately I was interested in this when I learned about it. And it's probably fair to say that I don't tune in to the tabletop Kickstarters really as much as I should, which is why I didn't find out about this until, you know, late 2023 when it had been a thing for a while. But honestly, COVID made me not pay attention to a lot of stuff that was going on in the space.
I went on a fact-finding mission because I was like, was it like 22 that this started? No, Brandon, we were both so wrong. And admittedly, we have good reason to have been so wrong. It was September 8th of 2020.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was some other stuff going on at that point.
we had a few things happening in our lives. And it looks like they had initially anticipated being able to ship things in 2021 mm-hmm. by like June. So I think that's part of why some folks being like, hey, shouldn't this have gotten to me like, I don't know, 2 years ago?
I was really confused because when I was doing research for this, I was looking on Reddit and I was seeing timestamps of like 3 years ago on there, people saying like, hey, so okay, so there are delays. And then I would see another one from like the following year, hey, so there are delays. You know, I'm sure there was I'm sure it was shipping delays, I'm sure it was materials delays, because I think there was like a paper shortage at some point there, so that probably led into it.
And everybody had issues at some point with trying to get things from a manufacturer to literally anywhere else.
Yeah.
So it's all kinds of problems that were there for a while.
Yeah. So no shade on Hit Point for that or anything.
No.
It's just what happens. And that's what happens when you back something on Kickstarter, right? Like you're always taking the chance that something's not going to happen. Obviously, you know, with somebody like Hit Point, there's a certain amount of guarantee that they're actually going to put it out.
Right. It's not a situation. That's, I think, the big thing is it's not a situation where it's like, I sank the $500 into this to get this super extreme double deluxe package and I'm so excited to get it. And then 4 years later, you see an update post that's like, so one of the partners stole all the money and they ran to Cancun and we don't know what to do now.
Yeah, I think it's probably more a case of there were a bunch of crates of Books of Hecna stuck on that ship that was trapped in the Suez Canal.
That is a distinct possibility. God, it has been a crazy 4 years, y'all.
Yeah. So, like I said up at the top with Hecna, like the key takeaway from it is, because I remember when I did first find out about this, the very first thing that I thought was like, wait a minute, isn't that essentially that Ravenloft supplement that came out post Curse of Strahd? Because it it had the it was calling back to the different demiplanes from like old school Ravenloft, and one of them was a carnival. And that's immediately where my head went on this. And, you know, reading the book, it did not take my head away from that at all. It's basically like they took the carnival from that. And I don't mean this in any sort of plagiaristic sense, just very thematic, inspirational. They took that and they expanded it into a full on setting, pretty much.
I mean, WotC is not the first group to come up. In fact, I think it was pre-WotC, that particular demiplane of Ravenloft existed. So it's not like they were the first ones, though, to come up with the idea of a hell carnival. So, like,
right? I'm not saying anybody stole anything.
Right. I don't think anybody could be accused of plagiarism, because you'd have to go all the way back to whatever the source of that is.
Yeah.
But I do think you are correct, and I also think it's intentional.
Yeah, and there were some things online that I found where people were talking about, like, there might have been some IP issue contributing to its delay, but none of that was substantiated at all in anything that I could have found on there. But
that seems like people drawing for drawing's sake.
People trying to find reasons why their book hasn't come yet. I mean, that's pretty much what it was. But
meanwhile, in the El Suez Canal.
Right, exactly. But, you know, strip everything away, and it's... And I don't mean this in any bad way, but it's impossible to look at this and not think, oh, that's lifted from Ravenloft thematically. Like, you can't really argue against that, I don't think, because I think they even use the word demiplane in the book. And there are other sort of similarities, how it's very easy to sort of accidentally wander into Hecna's realm. But once you're in, you can't get out. You know, there used to be a train that took people there. People could happen upon it accidentally. People could stumble into a carnival thinking it's normal and all of a sudden realize they can never get out.
Yeah. Not only is the word demiplane used in it, it's used in it several times.
Oh, good old control
just
F.
just in the introduction. Yeah, I was like, is the word demiplane used? It's used a lot. It's used multiple times. So I don't think that they were trying to avoid that. I think, in fact, they were leaning into that. I mean, they could have named the book anything and they named it Hecna.
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
they're clearly going, what we're going to do is we're going to take a big old bite out of WotC's pie, and there's really, it's legally distinct, so there's really nothing they can do about that. So neener.
Well, I guess anybody who produces 5e compatible content is already taking a big old bite out of WotC's pie. So
not a big enough bite, in my opinion.
Yeah, what? Let's steal some of the syrup that we're gonna put on top of it too.
Ah, syrup on top of your pie. Well, what are you doing?
Maybe not a syrup, but some sort of like additional topping, like you would put on top of a cheesecake or something. Like a scrub.
Oh, that's fair. That's Okay. I was not thinking about cheesecake. I was thinking about like a fruit, like a cherry pie, or something. Syrup on top, too much. You know. Anyway, tangents aside.
Yeah. Essentially, it's a 5-act story. And early in the book, it gives you a summary of everything and it breaks it all down into what's supposed to happen in each arc. It's very structured in that way, but it also provides a lot of flexibility. And that's one thing that I was struggling with as I was reading it, because it has such a structure for how everything is supposed to take place. Obviously, allowing you to sort of step off the path here and there, as long as A still leads to B. Ultimately, you can take a lot of routes to get there. But it's also described as a sandbox, which is interesting to me, because when I think of a setting being a sandbox, I do not think of it being structured, right? And part of, and you could say, well, it's a carnival. So yeah, you should be able to go to all the parts of the carnival and explore it and everything, but it doesn't really work like that, because in the book, there's a map of the carnival. And it's actually kind of funny because it reminds me of like Disney World maps, which I'm sure was intentional, but it has different areas marked out for what they are in it. And if you compare that with the act structure, it talks about certain places only getting unlocked after certain points. So that walks back the sandbox aspect of it for me a little bit. Like there's a section of it where you first start, I think it's called the Jamboree, and that's the like the lower level place where everybody can sort of get acclimated to it, and then you accomplish various quests and side quests there, and then it unlocks here, and then you do that, and then it unlocks here, and and then eventually you fight Hecna at the end. And Hecna throughout this game is sort of a Strahd-esque figure in that he appears every once in a while, and you can even fight him early at certain points of the game, but you're not meant to win. And there's mechanics in there that the designers throw in to be like, hey, if the party decides to fight Hecna early, do this, this, this. And it's, you know, really common sense stuff that a lot of experienced GMs would already know, like, you know, have Hecna treated as a joke or a laugh or something like that. And I'll tell you, when I read that, it really sort of solidified for me the vibes that I was getting from this game. Because I remember the first time I saw it, if you look online and look at the cover of it, it's, you know, very much sort of a Commedia dell'arte kind of clown. And they Commedia dell'arte is one of the influences that they call out in here for it. But I immediately looked at it and I thought, oh, that's Kefka from Final Fantasy VI. And then I heard the Kefka laugh in my head. So I'm reading through this and I'm seeing the parts about how Hecna used to be normal, but now has kind of gone insane. I'm like, oh, you'd be like Kefka from Final Fantasy VI. And then it talks about how you can fight Hecna at multiple points through the game and they're unwinnable fights until you get to the end. Oh, you mean kind of like Kefka from Final Fantasy VI. Like there's a train, like one of the side quests, it's less a side quest, I guess, more just an alternate way to win, is to be able to repair the train that used to bring people into the demiplane and take that to get out of there. And I'm like, well, all we need is some buff guy suplexing it. And then we're we're really deep into the Final Fantasy VI on this.
Yeah. Is the train haunted? I think is the important question here.
I don't know that for sure. But, you know, take that and couple it with what I was reading as at least a partially linear progression through the different sections of the carnival and how maybe each one of those is a sandbox unto itself, kind of like certain sections of Final Fantasy VI. And I was just really getting a JRPG kind of vibe from the structure of this. And that could be my own biases and my own gaming history coming into that. But I stepped away from it for a little bit and then I came back and I read it some more and I feel like there's a definite influence there.
That seems likely. I had not considered Hecna as a Kefka figure. I my head wasn't there at all until you said it. And then I felt like my head had exploded. I was like, what? Oh, my God. What I had been thinking of as I was reading through, like, what the areas are like and kind of what the locals are like and things like that was BioShock. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, here are all these things that at some point probably were benevolent and beautiful and funny and for entertaining. And they've just slowly all corrupted into something significantly more malevolent and evil.
Josh, I'll tell you something.
Yeah.
I've never played BioShock. Uh-huh. I am familiar with it and just sort of generally the concept of it. But I guess, is it fair to say that one of its primary themes is like decay?
Yes.
Okay.
Very much. The core concept of BioShock, spoilers for a 20-year-old game.
Is BioShock seriously 20 years old?
I think so, yeah.
Wow.
I was playing it at my parents' house in their basement, and given that I moved out at 19, it would need to be pretty close to 20 years old.
Wow.
The core concept is that you are a mysterious stranger visiting a place that used to be an underwater paradise and now is filled with essentially drug-crazed lunatics.
Okay. Okay, yeah, all right. I see the similarities there.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of, like,
people are doing experiments. There's a lot of technological things that occurred down there that would not have been able to occur anywhere else, but have caused like madness and mutation and people doing things like grafting blades to their arms and stuff like that. Like it's a wild ride. I think you would enjoy it. If only from a philosophical standpoint. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you do with shooters, but it's a great game. I enjoyed it a great deal. I was definitely getting those vibes from this because it's a lot of like, you walk into a space and there's still banners hanging that say things like Happy New Year. And all of your foes are wearing these like beautiful, elegant gowns and tuxedos and things like that. But they're torn and tattered and the figures inside of them are mutated, but also like raggedy and skinny. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, that was kind of a little bit the environment I was getting here, but I think this seems to have a little bit more of a comedic bent to it than BioShock did. Mm-hmm. BioShock tended to be very somber about a lot of its core material.
Yeah, and I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the tonal issues that I felt with when I was going through this, because I read it linearly. Like, I started at the beginning and I worked my way down through it. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to be a horror game. And first of all, I need to reiterate my usual thing anytime sort of a horror game comes up. And I think they're very difficult to run. I think it's very difficult to run a horror game, not even necessarily just in a D&D system, but it depends what kind of storyteller you are, because it's very difficult to create that tension while you're playing. And that's inherent to trying to run a horror game. And I actually think D&D is not the right choice of system to try to do that. Like you saw them try to do it back with, it might've been Ravenloft for like 3 or 3.5e. I can't remember. And then maybe 2e as well, but I'm not as familiar with the mechanics of how Ravenloft ran back then, but I don't think it ran differently than standard. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong. But basically there were, you know, you had fear, horror, and madness checks that were in addition to all the other checks that you would run. And that was a way to sort of mechanically replicate the effects of tension for horror. And I'm just not a big fan of that. I think when you try to turn that kind of storytelling and suspense building into a button or lever that you push to try to create an effect, I think it always falls flat. And this is totally unrelated to Hecna as a product. This is just me speaking sort of philosophically on running games. It's just very difficult to do. And I say that as somebody who is not good at it. I enjoy running Curse of Strahd, but I do a really crap job of trying to run a lot of the tension on it, because I think I tend to get a little too melodramatic with it. And if I'm being honest, I think most people probably get a little melodramatic when they try to run horror or something like that, because there's a lot of nuance to it. But anyways, I'm sort of like running away with this right now. But so that's thing one, is it's set up as a horror game. You're supposed to create tension. You're supposed to create unease, especially sort of with Hecna's insanity. And it becoming the kind of thing where you don't know what Hecna is going to do next. Are they going to laugh it off? Or are they going to kill you? Kind of like Kefka in Final Fantasy VI. but then you get further into it and you start getting into like magic items and equipment and spells and things like that. And it starts to take on a really cartoonish tone. Like, for example, one of the magic items is the Banana of Infinite Jest, and it's a wondrous item. And basically, it's a banana that you take and you throw, and you can like peel it, you can eat it, and then you throw it. And wherever the peel lands, it creates sort of a carpet of banana peels in like a 30-foot square for people to slip on. And I think that's great. I love it. Just in a complete vacuum, I love it as the concept for a magic item. But it's also like really sort of Tom and Jerry stuff going on there. Like, that's some Bugs Bunny versus Daffy Duck stuff. And there's nothing wrong with it. I just have trouble squaring that with what's supposed to be a horror campaign.
A lot of the magic items, I will say, end up making this feel very Muppets.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's that kind of slapstick.
That's a great way to look at it. It's very Gonzo.
Yeah, very slapstick, a little over the top. I mean, they've got the critic's crossbow, which is mm-hmm. an ebony crossbow inlaid with silver lettering, detailing colorful insults masquerading as criticisms.
You fire that, then you have to go, oh!
And its big effect is that you must succeed on a constitution saving throw when hit by it, or drop what you're holding as you, let's just say, have a bad time intestinally.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know talking about that can be a problem for some folks.
Yeah. I like how there's also a magic item called the disco stick. And we all know what the disco stick is. So that's really strange to see that in there.
Well, it's not. The good news is it's not what you think it is.
No.
It is, in fact, something very different.
Fortunately or unfortunately, it's not that.
Yeah, I have a feeling that a fair few of these were written in because they were jokes that they thought of while they were doing a carnival environment.
It honestly, probably some of these were contributed depending on somebody's Kickstarter tier.
That is also a possibility.
Yeah.
There is, at the very least, a couple of things like the Instrument of Destruction, which mm-hmm. is a series of musical instruments fashioned from fiend materials from the lower planes
mm-hmm.
that look like hideous, monstrous, nightmare fuel, but are in fact things like a drum, a violin, a flute, a saxophone.
Yeah, I guess one way to look at this is, like, let's refer back to what I was saying about, like, there's trouble running horror. Like, it's difficult to run horror.
Yep.
This gives you the sort of atonal parts that I see in here give you sort of an escape hatch if that's not how you want to run it and you want to run something that's a little bit sillier, which I'll admit sort of runs a little bit more toward how I like to do things. So maybe it's purposefully this way to give you a couple of different ways to lean with it. You know, and we can talk about that a little bit, like some of the run as intended kind of stuff when we get to talking about like the safety tools and stuff like that.
In
here. But yeah, that was just the big thing that I took away from it, is it seems like a comedy adventure that's trying to be an edgy horror adventure, but also not really going all in on it being an edgy horror adventure. And that's fine, because maybe that's an intentional design choice to give people who don't care for that kind of thing enough of a leg to stand on to still be able to run it.
I think that, speaking of running horror being difficult, the big thing that makes horror horrifying is the removal of control,
mm-hmm.
and the removal of the ability to protect yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's exceedingly challenging in a system like D&D. And so you almost have to be like, oh, yeah, it's this with horror elements.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not going to be that horrified. I mean, I think back to my first realization of this being a problem was playing Resident Evil 5,
mm-hmm.
Which is, in theory, a horror game where you are up against swarms of just vicious, vicious zombies. But you're armed with a submachine gun the entire time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're armed with also a rocket launcher. And it's like, I can't be afraid when I'm just mowing down lines of zombies with my submachine gun. That's fear is not a thing that's entering into my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I finally got my shooter arcade cabinet set up, and I've been playing House of the Dead 2 on it. And I'm not a huge fan of the House of the Dead series or anything, but I will say, because I constantly have to reload my pistols and I'm constantly getting rocked up, there is a definite feeling of mortality that I have going on there that I wouldn't necessarily have if I were firing an automatic weapon the entire time.
Yeah, like it's just not scary. And mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, one thing, and I'll talk about this, another part of this a little bit later, but one of the things that I read as a criticism online from folks who had gotten theirs and been playing it, even like, and in fairness, some of them offered this with the caveat that they were playing from the playtest that had come out, that there aren't really a lot of consequences in the game to motivate your party. Right. And this goes back to the sandbox element a little bit, too. This, and again, this is just some things that I read online from people who had played it for multiple sessions. And they would run into these issues where, you know, their party wouldn't get going where they needed to go. Right. And there was really no consequence to try to drive them in that direction. And I guess that's inherent. For sort of a sandbox setting, you as the GM have to help create the motivations for that. So maybe that was an issue on their part running it, trying, and maybe they were giving their players too much agency, if that's such a thing, you know. But I get where they're coming from, because I like when there are sort of time sensitive elements involved in games. Like, you know, we've heard and given the advice before that if your party is just like screwing around, you know, the villain is also not screwing around. The villain is still doing what they're doing. So there's always a chance that the party finally decides to stop shopping for hats after three sessions. And they find that the villain has already burned down the next town over where they were supposed to go save it, you know? So, but tying that back into the horror thing, like, I feel like for horror, and let's talk about Alien for a minute, there has to be constant pressure and constant threat being applied to the protagonists. And if you don't do that, then it's not horror, because if nothing's going to come for them, if nothing's going to drive them forward, if there's no threat with their inaction, then yeah, I can see that being a problem for something like that, because you have to have consequences to motivate them.
I mean, for a given value, but yeah, I agree. I think, I mean, if you're going to have, let me see here, 50 pages of monsters and non-player characters, then it seems to me like the environment that you're in should be pretty dangerous. And if the if the environment they're in is not dangerous, then why? Because the whole point of this is that it's supposed to be a deadly, devastating carnival, right? Like, it's possible that they didn't write in something explicitly to say, hey, you know what, if people aren't moving along, have a group of children of the candy corn wander into the store and start causing problems. Like, they can't spend three sessions buying hats because a popcorn swarm comes in. Like, there should be limited safe zones, and those safe zones should be available mostly for rest and planning and nothing else.
Yeah. And I guess you could implement some consequences through the rubes and revelers that they have, because there are essentially two types of people in the carnival. There's the rubes, and those are the people who have come into the carnival, but they haven't given themselves over to it. They're just sort of the victims of it. But then if you decide to accept the carnival in its way of life, you become a reveler, and you become sort of like part of the carnival. And there's actually sections in the book that talk about, like, hey, if your party becomes revelers, you can even run sort of like running a villain campaign or an evil campaign. You can have them as revelers instead of just standard adventurers. And it gives you a little bit of a guide on how to whatever character class they are, how to tweak that for a reveler.
That's pretty cool.
So yeah, you could have a thing, and maybe it's like falling to madness or something like that, where, you know, they have to make these checks, and if they sit around and are idle for too long, then they run the risk of sort of falling to the dark side of the carnival.
I mean, this is something I struggle with a little bit in my own writing, is knowing how much is enough and how much is too much. I have a tendency to give my GMs a lot of leeway, and part of that is because the way I write for brewery games, when I was writing in-depth, step-by-step, here's how the adventure goes, here's what you should do, here's what you should expect, no one ever ran 60% of what I wrote.
Right.
And part of that was their table took a direction that I couldn't have possibly foreseen, and they ended up using everything that was left of my notes as guidelines more than anything else, which is great. That's what they're there for. But I got to the point where I was like, if all I'm doing is writing for you guidelines, then all I should do is write for you guidelines. And I think it sounds to me like the GMs that were having a hard time with that were given guidelines when what they really needed was something more step by step. Because
they wanted rails.
Or at the very least, they wanted the path to be a little bit more defined. I personally can think of a dozen ways to get my party to stop shopping for hats. And I can use a variety of tools that exist within this book to create those situations. I mean, you could have a Rube walks in and the hat merchant wants to do something malevolent with the Rube, and the Rube starts a fight, and then the fight summons more attention on, like, there's all kinds of things that the party can get accidentally wrapped up in.
Yeah, that's true. And that's why I'm not giving that like a whole ton of weight. But maybe that calls into question like the need for sort of a specific section to talk about that. And asterisk, it might actually be in there and I just didn't see it because I was reading through it.
It is for everyone's knowledge, when Brandon and I are talking about, I've skimmed through a little bit of this section, a little bit of that section, we're talking about an almost 300 page book.
It's a
lot. There's a lot of content in here.
And I could choose between reading all 300 pages or reading some of the 300 pages, skimming the rest, and doing my homework today. And one of those things needs to take a little bit of priority. But I mean, I definitely feel that short of running the actual adventure, we have more than gotten sort of the gist of everything and have an understanding of how it runs. But I just thought that was, interesting that at least a couple of people specifically called out like a lack of consequences for the party in there. And maybe they were just looking for something thematic. Like maybe they were looking for a table, like you were saying, like some Rube goes into the hat shop and starts a fight and you have to deal with it.
Yeah, I think honestly, this is what tables are for, is, you know, your GM is feeling frustrated. They don't know what to do. That you have a break glass in case of emergency table for them to pull up and be like, here is a random occurrence that is going to happen in this region because you all have been messing around with the hat shop too much.
Yeah, for sure. Did you want to, I know we were big fans of the safety tools section. Did you want to jump into that?
So yeah. they have an entire page that is dedicated to safety, session zero, and describing the themes and giving you options for some of the themes that are a little bit harder to deal with that are in the game, which I think is tremendous. That's such a cool thing to be doing. The safety tools section is about what you would expect. It is the TTRPG safety toolkit, basically laid out in a very summarized form, along with pointing you to where you can get the full toolkit yourself if you'd like to make use of like the checklist and things like that. A little bit of details on lines and veils. They are talking about using X, N, and O cards. And then they suggest having aftercare since it's supposed to be a bit of a high stress, horrifying environment. You know, having a little bit of time after the game to come back to the real world and not spend the entire night thinking about what your character saw today.
Yeah, for sure.
Generally a good idea. They've got quite a few bullets for how to run a session zero, which I think is also tremendous. I think pretty much every book could use just a little. It does not have to be a lot. We're talking about here a total of like 20 lines of text. And some of those lines are very short because they're bullet points. Like, it's a wonderful concept that I think we could afford to see in a lot more books, just in general.
Yeah, running session zeros doesn't have to be complicated or really even time consuming. You just need to make sure you hit all the points and make sure everybody feels like they're informed and have had their say and feedback of everything. Because like looking at the list here of a lot of the themes and subject matter in it, like abusive relationships, body horror, childlike monsters, difficulty acquiring vegetarian vegan food, gaslighting. And that's really just like a partially the top third of the list. So there's a lot in here that you want people to be aware of, because it is, at least ostensibly, supposed to be a dark horror setting.
Right. And the thing that I really appreciate is that while they have the section that's like, here are all the things that are written in here, and they've got, God, I'm not going to even count that. That's like 15 bullets of different things that could be an issue for an individual player. They do not then go, this is how it's written. If you want something different, you got to pick a different system, blah, 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 which I've seen in a couple of places and I never appreciate, because it's like, you're the one who has the creative drive to create this system and this world and all of the things within it. You should then also give people a little bit to work off of. And Hit Point Press has done exactly that. They've got, for the three biggest triggering topics that they could think of, which are gaslighting and emotional abuse, past and continuing abusive relationships, and suicide and death, they've got not only detailed descriptions of where those things are in the game and how they're involved in the plot, they've got options for how you could pivot if one of those topics is an issue for someone at your table. They don't offer a lot of suggestions for things like, if somebody doesn't want to deal with spiders, even though spiders are a common theme in the game. But I think it's fair to assume that if somebody's playing at a table where they know that one of their players has an issue with spiders, they're probably used to going, okay, instead of a giant spider, we're going to have a giant squid monster. Go. Yeah.
And at the very end of this page, it has really good advice that I've iterated in various panels and stuff that we've done. And it says, sometimes a campaign just isn't a good fit for a player. A person may decide there are too many themes they're uncomfortable with and choose not to play this game, a decision that should be respected. And that just goes back to, sometime a GM isn't the right GM for the kind of game you want to play. Sometime a player is not the right kind of player for a game you want to run. And that doesn't mean those people are bad players or bad GMs. It's just like relationships. Like, people can be great, but maybe you're not great together. And it's just something that you accept and respect.
Yeah.
You know, don't try to force a square peg into a round hole.
No.
If you feel like you would have to change the game so much to accommodate other people, then maybe it's just not a good fit.
You might hate strawberry ice cream, and strawberry ice cream might be my favorite. We probably should not be serving ice cream for each other in that case.
Right. We should not start an ice cream company together.
We should not be attending each other's ice cream socials.
Oh, and related to the safety stuff is, the game actually makes a really solid effort on inclusivity in terms of explicitly like calling out pronoun usage and everything. On page 15, it has a specific subsection about pronouns and how to use them, and talks about how some people can sort of maliciously use pronouns, and basically how that's just not acceptable in this setting or in life. And it's good to see that called out. And then flowing down from that, for pretty much every character in the book, it lists pronouns, and it's included in some of the stat blocks and stuff too. And I thought that was just a nice walk the walk kind of inclusion in there.
Oh, absolutely. They've even got pronouns as diverse as Zizir and Zizir, which you don't see a lot in a lot of written materials. You see a lot of they, them, but not a lot of Zizir or Zizir, which I think is really cool. The sentence that they have at the end of the block, or I guess I should do both sentences. Give yourself and your players the grace to make mistakes. Be corrected or correct each other and move on. Mistakenly using the wrong pronoun isn't a crime, but willful misuse should be discouraged. Changing an NPC's stated pronouns is not recommended, as this is not reflective of the world of Hecna, nor the world in which we live.
Yeah, and it's good to see that up top essentially in the book, in sort of the setting, in the setting primer portion of it, to just sort of really let you know what's in the creators' heads and what their beliefs are and just how the game should be done. So that was nice to see.
Yeah, I appreciate that a great deal. Among the list of things I appreciate a great deal, they have a series of symbols and a conlang, or a constructed language, inside the universe, which I love little touches like those. I'm terrible at conlangs, but I love that they exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talking about the conlang for a second, I sort of have mixed feelings on this. I'm kind of a language nerd, so I appreciate a lot of the work that's been done in here, because it's essentially creating sort of a pidgin for this place. And it's, I think it's designed to feel a lot like maybe like a mid to late 18th century sort of Cockney dialect kind of thing. That's the vibe I get.
They outline that they're specifically going for a carnival worker slang vibe.
Okay. I mean, yeah, there's some overlap there. So that makes, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think it's great that they put all the work into this, but there is absolutely no way that I, as a GM, am going to take the time that is necessary to internalize so much of this that I will be able to use it to influence my NPC performances. And that's, I mean, that's saying something about me. That's not criticizing anybody or anything else. I think that something like this could be used as sort of a shortcut to telling better stories or better descriptions or something like that. Like, probably where I would use something like this is if it were in like notes or notices or something that the party finds, or like campaign handouts that I created or something. I don't take enough away from something like this for it to be useful to me, other than to maybe help give me vibes on how to run something. But it's just like, I mean, we're not kidding about how long this thing is. There's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. There's 9 pages of terms for this in a table. And there's numbers, there's words for polygons, just lots of common words. It's crazy. Like, so much work went into this. It's just not something that I find useful.
Yeah, I mean, I love a good conlang, and this looks like a particularly well-assembled conlang. I'm not great at languages, so I probably would have a hard time adapting this. But I also recall distinctly a time when I was like 14, 15, that I was getting really into the Lord of the Rings universe.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out that someone had constructed an Elvish dictionary, mm-hmm. and also how to say some of the words and things like that. And so I started teaching myself Elvish in part to impress a girl that I thought was really attractive at the time. But the big thing is, like, I spent hours and weeks learning a conlang at the time that mm-hmm. I didn't even know what the word conlang was. So I think I could absolutely see, especially for people who are a little more invested in world building and who want to have a little bit more fun with like the universe itself, I could see a whole group of friends going in and learning the conlang and then coming out of it still being able to basically speak their Klingon to each other,
mm-hmm.
and have people in the room be like, "What on earth?" And they're like, "Oh, don't worry about it."
I think a lot of it just comes down to how much time do you have to invest in what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because if you have a lot, then yeah, this, you could probably pick this up and make it really useful. If you don't, and you're just like, well, I bought this book so I can have a ready-made campaign setting that I didn't actually have to put a lot of time into building stuff with, then you're probably not going to be using that.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. As I understand it, the big thing with the conlang is it's there if you want to mess with it. You don't, it doesn't seem like you have to for at any point for any reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, if literally one person at the table wants to learn the conlang, the whole dictionary is there and it's all in kind of its own section in the appendices. Yeah. So it's not like you have to open it up to where there's potentially plot devastating stuff. You could just hand them the book at the very tail end and not have to worry about it so much.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also the symbols section, which is a basically a unique kind of thief symbol sort of situation.
That they have their own font for that you can download?
What? Yeah, there's a QR. There's a QR in there that you can scan that'll take you to it. So and I think cool. You can get it off Hecna.com as well. But it's interesting because it's symbols and then they can be put together in sort of like cartouches, like hieroglyphic style things to create proper names or complex names with like at multiple adjectives and things like that. And there are a couple of charts for it too. It's really interesting, if nothing else.
And also, again, exceptionally well done.
Yeah. Yeah. I encourage you to take a look at it, even if like much like the language, I don't think it's something that I would end up using unless maybe I were incorporating it into a puzzle or something and they had to figure out how to translate it. But that's the only way I think I might plug something like that in. But again, that goes to the level of time that I have to devote to anything.
I do think that a base level understanding of the symbols system is intended to be used throughout the campaign. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you don't have to get into building cartouches, I don't think.
Yeah.
That's something they included in case.
Right. Those were like the major points that we wanted to hit on this. The other thing I wanted to say to just sort of round it out is that the online feedback that I've read from it, from folks who've run multiple sessions in it, whether that was in playtest or more recently, because I've read some stuff really over the course of the last 3 years about it. And everybody sort of is universally like, it's really good. Like, it's really fun. It's really engaging. There are parts of it that I don't like. And maybe it's a situation where I'm going to take the parts that I like and incorporate it into my own game rather than running in this world. And, you know, those are all totally valid. But the bottom line is it's really positive. I really like what I've read on here. Probably the only other major criticism that I saw was people complaining that it didn't feel like populated enough. It didn't feel lived in enough. And when in the top of the book where it's laying out the setting, it lists like some notable NPCs, and it's actually a really small list of notable NPCs. And the thing I was seeing from folks was it would be really nice if there was a couple of pages just devoted to, you know, rubes and maybe some revelers that you could use to give it a more lived in feeling. Like these are people who actually live here and have lives. It just didn't feel like it was a real place where people have been trapped over the years, because time has really no meaning here. You're not supposed to use any kind of direct references to time. Like if somebody says, well, about what time is it? And you're not supposed to say, oh, it's 4 p.m. You're supposed to talk in terms of like, oh, it's been 3 hours since you got into this place, about 3 hours. Because much like Ravenloft, it's always nighttime. So there's no day-night cycle.
Yeah. I mean, there are, I will say on the NPC side of things, that was something I noticed. I thought it was interesting to include the NPCs in the bestiary. Mm-hmm. You don't see that a whole lot, but it does make sense from the standpoint of sometimes you're going to have NPCs that are just NPCs. Sometimes right. You're going to have NPCs that also have stat blocks.
Yeah, and there are some NPCs in there. I think maybe it's all the revelers. I'm not sure. Where it says, oh, they just use a bandit stat block. Which is fine. That simplifies my accounting wonderfully.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, it fits very well with your bear philosophy.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I love the bear philosophy. It's so easy.
But there's a few folks in here. I don't know. This is another one of those where I am inclined to write less and let my GMs have a little more free rein. Mm-hmm. But that I think is not necessarily a great fit for everybody. This is written right. Very much how I feel like I would write something in this vein were I to write something in this vein. And I like that a lot, because obviously I do. If I didn't like how I wrote, I'd write differently.
Right. No pun intended.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not cheap. But it is cheaper than buying something from WotC.
It's also 300 pages of content.
It's 300 pages of content. You can get it on Hit Point Press's website directly from them. The PDF is $29.99. The print book is $49.99. And then you can get the box set, which includes a bunch of stuff, for $100. And that also comes with like a dice set, I believe, and a handful of other things. It's very worthwhile. Like, obviously, too, if you have a local gaming store, pick it up there. But failing that, you know, buying it directly from the publisher is the way to go. And they make it easy for you. Hit Point Press also has frequent sales. And usually it's not like a whole heck of a lot of money off of it, but it'll at least make up for the shipping, probably. Because I bought Humblewood last year when they were having a liquidation sale on some irregular copies of it that just had misprints. So I was able to get a copy of Humblewood for like $5. And the only difference is I've got a sticker on the inside front cover that's like, hey, here are the pages where some stuff's wrong and here's what it should be. And that was fantastic. It ended up costing me, I think, $10 because the shipping was $5, which honestly, for a hardback print book, only $5 shipping, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's wild. So keep an eye out. I would subscribe to Hit Point's newsletter, because that's probably where you're going to find out about sales and stuff from them. But they were really good folks. I really enjoyed talking to them at PAX Unplugged. So check this out. Like we said, even if you don't want to run in the full adventure, as with anything like this, there are bits and pieces you can take from it. Like, maybe you only want to use the initial stage of the carnival, the jamboree. Maybe that's just something you want to use and plug into, you know, your particular setting, and just have sort of a light dark carnival there.
Maybe you don't like the dark carnival that's in the demiplane from Ravenloft. Maybe you want this instead. That also works. I will also state my appreciation for, if you buy the digital version, they give you a PDF to download. It is admittedly a 161 megabyte PDF, but it is a downloadable PDF, so that if their store goes offline, you still have it.
Yeah. Also, it's a fully indexed PDF, which is honestly the only thing that I expect from a professional operation.
Yes.
Nowadays.
Yes.
If you're producing something that's 300 pages long.
Yeah, the fact that you can click on the chapters and be taken there. You know what I didn't check is if you can click on. Okay, so it's great, but it's not so great as to be crazy, because I can't go.
It's not a linked PDF.
I can't go to the index and then click on like adjusting themes and be taken to adjusting themes.
As someone who's created their fair share of complex PDFs over the course of my career, that's not something you just sit down in an afternoon and knock out. So I can totally understand that.
No, I it's 100% fair. I just wanted to see if they had like really, really done a ludicrous amount of work on this PDF.
But yeah, check it out. If you do pick it up and you get a chance to read through it, you get a chance to play it, let us know what you think of it. Cause really curious to see how your response to it lines up with ours. Because we're not right. We may not be wrong. We may not be right. We just are.
We're just a couple of dudes with a podcast.
Yep. Josh, tell them what they need to know.
There's many things that they need to know. First of all, they should tell a friend about the Goblins and Growlers podcast. I have been tripping all over my words today, because the word of the mouth is the best way for us to get additional listeners, or if you're a YouTube follower, viewers, and
please PLZ subscribe to the YouTube channel.
And we don't spend currently any money on advertising. So really, you advertising is the best we're going to get right now, because our budget is limited.
Yes. If we told you how limited it was, you would feel sorry for us.
I love the number of times we'll have somebody approach us at a con and be like, oh my God, you get to do this full time as your job? And I'm like, no, this has never paid a bill in my life, but I love doing it.
I laugh at them as they walk away. But yeah, we've got 106 subscribers on the YouTube channel which sat dormant at like 59 subscribers for a long time before I actually started putting some effort into it. So we're on the road to 200.
We only really needed 10 more, and we've got so much beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very excited.
Folks should come and join the conversation on our Discord. That's bit.ly/goblindiscord, all lowercase. That's the best place to reach me because that's where I live. That's my home away from home.
I've looked over Josh's shoulder before when he's had his Discord app up on his laptop, and it is just a terrifying and heartbreaking scene to me to see how many servers that he's on. Yet he still manages to commit so much time and effort to the Goblins and Growlers Discord server.
My brother asked me how many servers I'm in because my other brother made me join two more so I could play Helldivers 2 with him. And I counted. I'm at 33 right now.
That's insane. I feel bad when I look at mine and I've got maybe like 10. Like that's just crazy.
I've got 33. I'm only really active in like 10, to be totally honest. There's a fair few of those that are like fan communities for things I like that I sometimes pop in and see what the latest news is. I'm on Kobold Press's Discord. It just makes sense. Folks should also follow our sister podcast, Quid Pro Roll, which is a Dungeons & Dragons 5e podcast narrative play where my wife, Alex, wanted to make a campaign about dragons being brought back to a world, metallic dragons to fight the chromatic dragons, which are now holding power. And the rest of us came along and we were like, what if, hold on, consider crazy shenanigans? Setting fire to various towns, perhaps. Could that be a good time for you? And she said, maybe not for me specifically, but it makes good audio. And so we are where we are. And then finally, you should go to our Linktree, linktr.ee/goblinsandgrowlers, and sign up for the newsletter that Brandon puts out once every month. It's a very quick read. It's also clear when you read it that Brandon worked in editing for a newspaper because it says things like 3-minute read for individual sections so that you know exactly what kind of commitment you're putting in right off the bat.
Yeah. If the entire newsletter takes more than 3 minutes to read, I feel like I've failed. Because your time, listener, is valuable, and I'm trying to respect it.
The way in which you synopsize things with just real quick bullet points so that if someone wants to dig in deeper, if they're like, well, now I'm curious about this, you then link for the thing that you're talking about. I love that. I think that's great. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful work.
Too many newsletters that I subscribe to want to send me a novel every week. And I just absolutely do not have the time or patience for that. If you can't boil it down into like a sentence or two, you haven't internalized it enough.
Yeah. Give me the opportunity to become curious about this thing. And then if I'm curious about it, give me the opportunity to look at the information you were looking at. But that's
why we have a good open rate and click-through rate.
Yeah. So go get the newsletter. That link tree also has all of our social media, our website, and our merch page.
Mm-hmm. And if you're the organizer or content developer for a convention on the East Coast or maybe the eastern part of the Midwest, and you're interested in somebody to do panels, performances, and run tables for Dungeons & Dragons and perhaps other games at your convention to provide extra turnkey programming, please reach out to us at contact@goblinsandgrowlers.com.
Hell yeah. I will say, I don't know about you, I would hop onto a plane to go to California to go to a convention there. I just don't think most people are going to pay us to do that because that's an expensive plane ticket.
Yeah. Also, like, travel is a hassle.
It is.
I have to fly to New York in a couple of weeks and I'm just like, I really don't want to. And it's not because I'm not excited about the work that I have to do up there. It's just man, that's a hassle. Yeah. Have to go to the airport, do that, come back.
And we can't bring a booth with us on a plane. That's not a thing we can do.
A guy I used to work with, he would go hiking in the west, like Big Sky country and western states and stuff like that. And he would just ship all of his hiking equipment to a post office near where he was going. And he would fly out there and then he would pick it up and then he would ship it back at the end. We should just do that with the booth.
We'd have to get better at packing the booth than we currently are.
I know.
Palletize. Like, we got to be able to palletize it.
Yeah, clean out the storage unit first, and then we can do all that. All right. We may have something fun and interesting for the next episode. It might involve some streaming. We're really not sure yet, but should be a good time. Should be a good time. But Josh, if that's all you got, I think we can let the people have their day back.
That's all I got. Thanks, y'all, for tuning in.
Yeah, everybody have a good one.
Bye.
If you like what you hear, consider subscribing and giving us a review over on Apple Podcasts. Especially early in the feed, subscriptions and reviews are super helpful for bringing new listeners our way. Thank you!